Brighten up your home with help from Menards. Illuminate your home with LED light bulbs from Fight Electric. They provide light that lasts with a rated life of over 10,000 hours. Don't wait to finish your projects. Save big money on Fight Electric LED light bulbs now at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hi. Barb Nagel, welcome to Shift Talking. Thank you so much for being here with me and also, again, for giving me flexibility this morning.
Absolutely.
So I have been binging your podcast. I was listening to it all morning while I was getting ready. My kids heard it in the background. And
oh, no. Did they hear the F word?
Yeah. They hear my F words.
Okay.
We don't talk about it as if they're like bad words. We say that they're just grown up words. In the same way that you'll drive when you're growing up, when you're doing all of these other things, you'll also use these words.
So smart.
They're used to it.
Nice.
So the one that I was listening to right before we got on was the emotional unavailability. And I love it so much. I didn't get to finish it, but I was like enthralled. And I think you do, just throughout your entire podcast, you do such a beautiful job of diluting this information in very approachable ways, right? Like I tend to get a little bit wordy and kind of talk around and chase the squirrel down every branch while I'm trying to make it to the top of the tree. And you do such a beautiful job of breaking that down. And so first I wanted to just share that with you
You know what's hilarious, Davina, is before I got into 12-step recovery my whole life, people were like, what are you trying to say? Get to the point. And I get feedback pretty regularly that I'm clear and succinct. And it's like, I guess I have boundaries around my thoughts and my words now or something. I don't really know, but it's crazy. You know, I'm just talking. I'm just sharing whatever, you know.
What do you think pivoted that, right? Because then we do have that like land your plane kind of thing. So what do you think pivoted that as you did more of the work that allowed for you to, I don't know that it's maybe more concise, but maybe even more confident in what you're saying?
Yeah, I think I'm centered in, I think of it as situated in myself. I'm not focused on what other people think. I'm not trying to impress anybody. I'm just trying to talk. I'm just trying to communicate. There's no, I don't have an agenda like, okay, if I say it just the right way, if I do these right things, then they're going to like me. I also used to give way too much information to people as a way to kind of convince them to listen to me and also to kind of convince myself that what I was saying was right. And I don't, again, no agenda there. I'm not trying to do that. I just have so much more clarity about so many things. Like if you think about it, a lack of boundaries is a lack of clarity. Like boundaries are clear. When you don't have boundaries, you have like blurriness. Or like, I was talking with a client this morning, we were talking about like, you know, when we don't have boundaries, we're amorphous. It's like, there's a part of us that's kind of the same, but there's this edge that's moving and shadowy and cloudy and you know, undetermined. And so what we're trying to determine is like, where do I end and other people begin? And I feel like that has carryover to so many things. So for example, one of the things that's happened for me is that I used to literally feel other people's feelings. Like I was permeable and I don't anymore. And my experience is that it's almost like there's this energetic boundary or barrier that evolves as you get better boundaries, whereby people's stuff just doesn't penetrate you. I don't know how that works, but I also don't know how electricity works, and I don't need to. I just know that it does. And it's not just me. Like it happens for my clients. It's happened for people I'm in recovery. And I think for me, it started with me literally putting my hand up and being like, this is an energetic stop sign right here. And I need that energy to not come at me. But there's also the fact that like I'm situated in here. So I'm not, my radar isn't out there like boop, 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 boop. Like what am I reading everybody constantly to try to figure out what's going on? My radar is like folded down, you know, and put away.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I hear it. And, you know, my husband We just celebrated his 4-year sobriety birthday.
Oh, fantastic. Earlier.
Yeah, 3 days ago. And so I learned a lot when he went into recovery. We had a crisis. And around that time, he started improving and I started getting resentful. And it was just this part where I saw him being guided through. He got a sponsor. He had a care team. He had all of this. And I'm out here like, okay, no hands. Like, I'll just figure it out. Fuck me, right? Like, there was just so much of that around then is when I realized that he was not the only problem, that like his drinking was not the only problem and that I was contributing. And so where so much of my work went into was my codependency, my enmeshment, my people pleasing, my secrecy around his drinking of what would people think and what would that mean about me. And then once people know about it, then that means I'm going to have to change something and I don't even know what to change and I'm not ready and I don't want to lose him, but I don't want to lose myself. And it became this just full clusterfuck of an experience that now we're deeply grateful for. Like at the time, of course, it was atrocious.
Yeah.
And now it's something that we neared separation and then we actively chose to rewrite the narrative of our marriage, of our parenting, of all of this.
Congratulations. And
thank you. It has been so much work and also the greatest thing because around those boundaries is where I got to do that work and figure out, like, with good intention came really poor impact and enabling of multiple years of heavy use and me kind of destroying my identity in order to preserve his and our outside one, right? And so boundaries has been something that I'm getting really good at. I'm still working on, of course, and way better than I was before. And I do think that there is a confidence that comes through. And as you were sharing about the emotional unavailability in that episode, and I'll link that one here because I think it was just so wonderful. You talked about how a lot of it was just intolerance of carrying other people's or expecting to change theirs. And that just, it hits so hard. And so with that segue, I want to ask you, for those of us who either witness somebody else's like rock bottom crisis, whatever, that don't experience it by proxy, or for those of us who are just kind of in the middle where it's like neutral, more negative neutral, but there's not this like big life altering event that prompts this, how do you suggest that they even start kind of dipping their toe in the boundary water?
Yeah, I mean, I think my recommendation for everybody, regardless of why, if they want to start working on boundaries, is to start with teeny tiny boundaries with yourself. So I'm not going to open that email until I have the psychic wherewithal to do so. Mm-hmm. And then you don't open the email. Right. And then what's going to come up, this is why people don't set boundaries, is feelings. You're going to have some feelings.
Yeah.
And part of the process of learning to build healthy boundaries is learning to manage your feelings. And manage means, among other things, feeling them. So instead of trying to make the feelings go away by doing some kind of numbing behavior or dissociative behavior, like opening the email and feeling like you're in control, you feel that. And you act like, what is going on here? What am I telling myself is going to happen if I don't open that email? So you're probably telling yourself something like, so this was me. I'm a bad person if I don't respond to this email, or that person is going to think I'm a bad person. Like, I literally said that about my ex-boyfriend when I first got into recovery, and my fellow travelers were like, he doesn't know when you open the email. Like, I'm not dumb, Davina. Okay. Yeah. I'm not.
Yeah.
But somehow I needed someone to tell me that.
Of course.
You know?
Yeah.
And then also, Barb, he's your ex-boyfriend. You do not have a relationship with him. Mm. You know, so you start with something for yourself that's small. That way, any repercussions only involve you. But some people have such terrible boundaries with themselves and they might be better with other people. Then, if that's the case, you start with a small boundary with another person who you know is like an emotionally mature, reasonable person, not like the most egregious boundary violator. And you just, you set a boundary with someone who is likely to be like, oh, okay, I didn't know. And then you see, and you're still gonna probably still gonna have feelings, even if they say yes. You might feel, usually it's guilt and shame that most people feel. That you feel guilty and shameful, and like allow yourself to feel that. You're gonna have teeny tiny little guilt and shame by doing a teeny tiny little boundary with emotionally safe and healthy, mature person, right? So then you can like dose yourself with little tiny bits of guilt and shame. Allow yourself to feel it. Realize you didn't die. Like I literally would say a lot of the time, me and the step group of women that I did the steps with, we'd be like, and I didn't die. We would tell ourselves, I didn't die. And I felt like for me, I was like, I have to hear that in my brain. So hopefully it eventually dumps into my subconscious brain that I have all this evidence of not dying from things that made me feel like I was going to die from even thinking about doing them. Never mind doing them, thinking about doing them. It was like, and you're not going to die. People have not died from setting a boundary. It's not, it's not like the feelings from setting a boundary have not killed you, anybody.
And that's where I think that there's that part around not having a ton of, I keep saying confidence, but this is more so around my ability to tolerate that later. Right. A lot of the time I would just, before all of this, right, I would attempt to set a boundary with my husband, but really there were just threats that I was hoping that he wouldn't make me catch him on and follow through with. But what ended up coming of that was, I don't know how I'm going to manage this, right? Like, I know I feel this way. I know I want something to change. I'm assuming that he's the one who has to change. And if he would only do this, then I would be just sitting pretty. And then it would be, well, this feels icky. Like, I don't know how to sit in this. This is so fucking gross. So let me just do something else instead. Let me sacrifice my like sense of self and my self-respect for
I
that
have
like
so much to
temporary.
say about what you just said. So much.
Yeah,
Hopefully
sure.
I remember it all. So what you just spoke out of victim mentality. Like, I really want him to change. If only he would change and everything would be okay. So this was hands down the biggest paradigm shift of my recovery was coming out of victim mentality. And I am not the quintessential, like, woe is me, the world is against me, nobody loves me kind of victim. Mine, way more subtle, just like you, if only. If only. So your attempts to set boundaries with him were not attempts to set boundaries. They were attempts to control him. There's a difference. Control is about them, boundaries are about you. You called it threats. I tell my clients, if you set a boundary with someone and they don't honor it and you don't follow through with consequences, it wasn't a boundary. It was a hope or a wish. Like, oh, I wish he would just listen to me. Or I hope he's going to change. I hope I don't have to do anything to actually make sure that I follow through on this, right? That's what's happening for many of us. And so, like, here's the thing. Newsflash, you cannot control other people. That, like, I heard those words a gajillion times before I got in recovery. This is why the Serenity Prayer is so popular in recovery. And if you don't mind, I'd like to say it just in case people aren't
Please,
familiar
of
with it.
course.
So it's God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. That is one of the greatest tasks of life, is continually discerning, can I control this or can I not? If I cannot, then I might need a higher power's help to get me to accept I don't like this. If it's something I can control, I might need higher power's help to get some courage to change the thing that I can. And I personally believe it's really the prayer is all about boundaries. Where's the boundary? Is this in my control or is it not in my control? And so it's one of the toughest tasks of life, but you get better and better and better at it. And what happened for me as I built boundaries, which by the way, I did in the context of 12-step recovery. I started in recovery for codependence, then got into recovery for intergenerational family dysfunction through the Adult Children of Alcoholics and Dysfunctional Families program. I didn't know I qualified for it. It's a trauma recovery program where you reparent yourself and you use the 12 steps. I didn't know any of that. I didn't like, and it's transformed my life. In fact, this Friday is my 10-year anniversary
for
in that
you.
Program. And it's absolutely revolutionized my life. And so it's not like I didn't take a course on boundaries. Nobody sat me down. I didn't hire a boundaries coach. It was just a byproduct of my recovery. But because codependence is like my core wound, boundaries just radically changed everything. And they also, boundaries permeate every area of your life. You know, your relationships, your relationship with time, how like your emotional life, your energy, your money, your work, your work-life balance, like they literally permeate every single area of your life. So when you clean up boundaries, you have the potential to clean up like literally every area of your life. And I'm starting to lose where I was going with this. So, learning how to build healthy boundaries for me, a byproduct of that was coming out of victim mentality. And that's because we're talking about the victim, or usually called the drama triangle. Are you familiar with the drama triangle?
No.
So the drama triangle is a dysfunctional pattern that includes three roles. So the victim, the rescuer, and the persecutor.
Yes.
And most people have an out-of-the-gate position. So for me, my out-of-the-gate position is rescuer.
Same.
That's, you know, no boundaries, rescuer, fixer, savior. But everybody who has one of those things, we all bebop around that triangle. And you can do it alone with no other interaction with other people. There could be two people involved. The thing about drama triangles is if you've grown up in dysfunction, your family lives in the drama triangle constantly. Every family gets into it a little bit here and there. So you can't have a victim without a rescuer, and then you also have a persecutor. So they're persecuting the victim, like, you're such a victim, but they're also persecuting the rescuer, like, why don't you let him like have his own repercussions? But nobody stays in just the one position. They all bebop around in that. And so for me, like, it was pretty easy to see my rescuing behavior. It was very difficult for me to see my persecuting behavior, which is my lowest role. And most of that was stuff in my head. It wasn't stuff that was coming out of my mouth, but occasionally it did. And then my victim mentality was so subtle that it was really, really difficult for me to spot. And I have a number of episodes on my podcast about it. And it's because every time I start to see more of my victim mentality, I do another episode because it's so insidious. And so, like, victims don't feel like they have choice. They feel like they have no options. And I want to say something about this victim mentality before I go further. Chances are exceedingly high, if you have victim mentality, you have been victimized in some capacity, whether you know it or not. So the mentality does not come out of nowhere. It comes from somewhere. The thing is, it's a mentality that can be changed. So the article that is coming out in my newsletter this week, I use this, what I heard is the story of when they train elephants for the circus. So when they're babies, they chain them and they try to pull away from the post and they try to break the chain and they can't. And then they give up. And as they grow older, they just put a rope that the adult could easily break, but they don't even bother trying because they gave up. They have no hope. That is victim mentality. And the thing is with humans is that can also permeate every single area of your life. So I, like, an example for me was I felt like I was a victim of traffic. Like, I acted like there shouldn't be traffic on the highway, at least when I'm driving, and it's happening at me or to me.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, highways were invented for traffic, right? If you're upset that there's traffic on the highway, you are in victim mentality. So if you complain a lot, if you blame a lot, if you say, if only, if you say, I have no choice, if you're waiting for other people to change, if you're waiting for the world to change, that's victim mentality. And I feel like I can probably safely say every one of my clients has victim mentality to one degree or another, but most of them to a larger degree rather than a lesser. I think it kind of goes hand in hand because of the drama triangle.
Yeah, I, no, you're entirely right. And there is kind of that. So when we're doing this, what I found was I kind of lived within that for a very long time, right? It was this mentality that, like, I had been wounded and it's your job to fix it. So, like, if you want me, if I want me, rather, to, like, go and thrive and do all of these things, like, first you need to stitch me up.
And what that ended up,
yeah, it ended up just fucking with me because no one else could. And I wouldn't, even if they tried to, I wouldn't sit still long enough because it just hurt too bad, right? And so there was so much of that that came through that as we're doing more of this work, there's so much more power to it. And I did not realize at the time how much of my own existence, my image of myself, my efficacy was completely contingent upon how other people acted. And then it was this concept of Sonder. Are you familiar with it? It's basically just the wording that we've attached to the fact that everyone else is the main character of their lives and their lives are just as rich and detailed and deep as ours are. And we're purely bystanders. Sonder, S-O-N-D-E-R.
S-O-N-D-E-R. Okay, cool. I'm going to look it up.
And it's such a beautiful concept. And it was that, and I think paired with any level of gratitude. So, like, sometimes my kids, we used to commute really far for their schools, and they're 5 and 8, and they would just be like, oh, traffic, we're in the car for so long, la da da. And whenever we would say that there was an accident, or whenever we would see that there was an accident or anything going on, I'm like, wow, like, I'm grateful that that's not us, right? Like, we get to sit in here, we're happy, we're healthy, we're listening to Doggyland on Spotify, like, we are good, and all we have to do is just wait a little bit longer.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of these kind of mindset shifts that they, of course, through the work, they happen so incrementally. And now when we look back, it's like, whoa, this is coming so naturally now. Yeah. And that's what I think is so hard about this work is that it's so abstract that we don't quite realize it at that time. Yeah.
So it actually doesn't have to be abstract. Like, I have a very structured curriculum that I take people through that is transformational. So it's a 12-week boundaries curriculum. It's multimedia. So there are PowerPoints, there are podcasts, there are articles, there's a workbook. And then there's lots of conversation. So the people can take in the information in multiple ways. And it's like, we're going to do module one, and it's going to contain this information and this mindset stuff. And these are the exercises and all that stuff. So it doesn't have to be completely, you know.
Yeah.
Like that. But that's how it was for me. I just, like, haphazardly, like, I did this meandering haphazard path in recovery to build healthy boundaries. And after I had a handle on boundaries, I was like, this is amazing. Let me do some reading about boundaries, which helped me to retroactively understand what happened. But when I was reading those books, I've discovered I'm a very visual person. So it was like words. So I would, like, draw these images to visually depict what I was seeing. Yeah. Well, those drawings turned into handouts, which turned into a workbook, which is the backbone of my boundaries coaching program. And so it's also, like, my curriculum also helps people who are visual learners too. But I want to say something about, I don't remember exactly what you said, but there was a phrase I'm going to share with you in a moment that I heard on a recovery podcast years ago. And I was like, oh my God, like, wow. Cause, you know, you said the changes happen incrementally, but sometimes we get hit with something that is just, like, has this reverberating effect on me. And that's this phrase: let go of your expectations of others and meet your own needs. And I was like, wait, I had been starting to understand the idea of letting go of my expectations of others. I'd heard for years that, you know, expectations or premeditated resentments or, you know, that sort of thing. And I was starting to get to understand, like, what a problem expectations were in my life. It turns out it was one of my worst, we call them defects of character in 12-step recovery, was unrealistic expectations of myself, other people, and the world. I wanted things to be the way I wanted them to be.
Yeah.
So when I heard let go of your expectations of others and meet your own needs, I was like, whoa, what does that mean? And it took me a long time to really internalize it. And the way I did it, Davina, is I would flip through my journal to like 10 pages ahead and I would write that across the top of it so that the day that I got to that blank page, there was no missing it. And I would say to myself, was there a time today when I could have let go of my expectations of others and my own needs? And for the longest time, the answer was yes. And it was basically I untrained myself for how to depend on other people and how to let go of expectations and really meet my own needs. Often my needs were for things like affirmation. Often the way I met my own needs was by setting a boundary with someone. But I want to give you a couple of examples that may seem really tiny and mundane, but multiply this times like 10,000. So my sweetheart and I do not live together. We sleep over each other's houses. And at his house, he has all these scratchy blankets that make lots of noise. And I need like silent, soft blankets. Before recovery and before having healthy boundaries and knowing how to meet my own needs, I would have expected that he should have a soft, quiet blanket for me, that he should know that. And then every time I went to use one of his scratchy, loud blankets, I would be pissed off. I would never say anything. I would hold him accountable. And I would be basically starting to build wall, brick by brick by brick, higher and thicker between he and I. Multiply that times the 10,000 things that I did that with. But now I know how to let go of my expectations of others and meet my own needs. And I bought a blanket that's soft and I brought it to his house. And I'm like, when I'm here, this is my blanket. You can use it all you want when I'm not, but when I'm here. And then, so another time, he's a very visual and very complimentary person. And this one day, he was here visiting me, and I went downstairs and I had this new blouse that I loved on. And he was not having a really good day, and he didn't say anything. And I realized that I expected that he would compliment me on my blouse. And I came upstairs and I looked in the mirror and I was like, you look really nice, Bart. So I gave myself the affirmation I wanted. I could have met my own needs by saying to him, what do you think of my blouse? And I know he would have said, oh, you look great, or something like that, because that's what he's like. But I decided to like truly meet my own need. So when we let go of our expectations of others and meet our own needs, we stop trying to control people. We stop trying to manipulate people, and we start basically getting in the driver's seat of our own lives and driving our own car instead of telling other people how to drive their cars from the sidewalk.
Without a license. Yeah, I mean, there's yes. And I agree with this. I hear it and I like absorb this entirely. What I had a hard time doing, and what I my the foundation of the work that I do is rooted in my training in therapy, but mainly in anger management, right? Which is, of course, like all about control and lack of boundaries and these things. And so many of us and so many just people in general, right, experience so much of this where we have to meet our own needs from a young age that by the time we get to adulthood, we're just fucking exhausted. And we're just ready for someone else to do it for us, if not fully demanding it. And that kind of like, I'm not a win-lose person. I am very competitive. And when I use this phrasing, I more so mean like losing against what I think should be happening, of course, like this expectation, but it felt like losing to me, like me taking that power and being given that power, or even giving myself that power to make these decisions for myself and be that person for myself. One felt exhausting, and it just felt like losing. And so that was a hard kind of shift for me to make mentally, right? In that. Share with me. I
I
see
can
you.
imagine. And I think, you know, w I ideally the kinds of relationships we want with other humans are interdependent relationships, right? So I can depend on you and you can depend on me. We don't need each other, we want each other, right? Like, I want your approval, but I don't need it the way that I used to. So it's fine for me to give my own approval. I do want, like, he tells me compliments will get you everywhere, and I tell him compliments will get you everywhere. Like, we mostly focus on good things about each other. And it's easy when you don't live together. Because I've lived with, you know, quite a number of partners. But I also was not in a relationship when I built boundaries. And when I met him, by the way, it's my first and only healthy relationship. We've been together for 6.5 years. I was 55 and he was 60 when we met. So it's not too late, people. And, So I was pretty clear. This man needs to enhance my life for to stick around. Like, it was like, I knew I had up-leveled my life massively, and whoever I was going to date needed to like bring it like to the next level. There was no bringing me down. Like, I was not. And it was so clear when I started dating him that I was a different person. I even said to him, like, this woman has never dated because she never existed before. So some of the things, I don't know what's going to come out of me. So I really, I got to be single and meet my own needs. And then I had to kind of step into how much do I want him to do for me? So couple things. One, lifelong feminist. I was shocked to realize when I got into this relationship with him, where I know who I am, that I actually really believe in a lot of stereotypical gender roles. Like, I wouldn't have allowed myself to admit that in the past, but I couldn't see it. And so there's that. That took me a while to figure out. But like, he wanted to carry my bags out to the car for me, and I was like, I got it. He was like, I know you do. I want to do this for you. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay. And it got to the point where I could eventually say to him, we actually joke about it, and I say, like, will you carry my books out to the car? Am I carrying my books home from school for me? Like, we do this joking thing like we're teenagers, you know, because neither one of us got to be the kind of teenagers we wanted to be. And so we act that way now. So we like play it up. Like, he's going to carry my books home from school for me because like, he's a man. And I'm like, I'm a girl. Like, I don't need anybody to do anything for me, but I want him to. And it took me a while to step into how much of my quote needs do I want him to meet for me, and how much. So I had to do kind of the opposite of you as I'm talking this through. Like, you were like, I'm sick of meeting my own needs here. I need you to take on some of them. And I was like, I'm finally taking care of my own needs here. How much do I let someone else, you know, help me with? And being clear and direct about it, instead of doing it in some surreptitious way where you're manipulating them into either believing it's their idea or that there's something wrong with them if they don't meet your need, or you're going to punish them by giving them the silent treatment or whatever. You know, it's like being really clear and saying, are you able to do this thing for me? You know,
mm-hmm. And being open to hearing no, if that's
right.
Like, right. I used to always give an option, but then like, you don't have an option. Did you not know this? Right. Like, I'm telling you, like, are you open to doing this? And it's yes.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So what you're talking about is like, people with poor boundaries are usually pretty clear. Like, people are walking all over me, but what they don't understand is they don't respect other people's boundaries by and large. I mean, it might not be the case, but most people, like, I had no idea. I was literally trampling all over other people's boundaries all the time. And I started to see it, and I was like, oh my God. Like, I had this one couple, and I ran into them in like a sub shop somewhere, and I was brand new in recovery, and I walked out. I'm like, oh my God, the three things I just said to them, no wonder they never contact me anymore. But I couldn't see it until after the stuff came out of my mouth and I walked out the door, and I was like, oh. So I waited a couple weeks, and then I sent them an email apologizing and saying, when I left, I realized, now I know why they don't call me. When I said these things, I should never have said them. And I can see now, and I never heard from them again. I don't know if they ever read them, but I was like, so what we call that in recovery is my part in things. I didn't know what my part was. I didn't know the things I was doing and saying to create the chaos and drama, or to exacerbate the already existing chaos and drama around me. And there was a lot.
Yeah, I share very honestly that I got into anger management in an attempt to fix my husband. Because he, you know, he would wild out. Right. Like, he would get triggered, quote unquote, easily, and then punch something, throw something, you know, just get very, very large and loud. And he wasn't open to doing the work because he had been, you know, his own stuff. Right. His own resistance. And I then, through my training in it, I had this like, you know, in like movies when they depict this like sinking feeling when like the whole room kind of shrinks in around you. I had that in the middle of this training, because I was completely bulldozing every need that he expressed that he needed in those moments, down to like blocking the door. And no fucking wonder this dude would hit something, because he's telling me, like, I need to leave. And I'm like, no, we need to talk about this. No, you need to be able to talk about your feelings, you know? And it was only because I didn't know how to tolerate what would happen once he walked out the door. He's likely to come back. All evidence shows he's going to be back. I didn't know that, and I didn't know how to sit within it. And I didn't realize that in order for me to get my needs met, because I would have preferred for him to be screaming in my face than taking 10 minutes to cool down outside, that I was completely robbing him of the opportunity to go. And then you bring in the gender role, right? Like, if I'm blocking his point of exit, he's not going to put hands on me. Even to move me out of the way, because then that's pushing me. You put hands on a woman, right? And so there were so many of these things that I recognized that I set him up for failure in so many ways. I trampled him. I disrespected him. I engaged in these ways that, looking back, were one, just embarrassing, and two, just so out of wounds, sure, and just so fucked up. So fucked up. Now I can kind of see those things. And now when I look back on those, it's not like, oh yeah, he punched that and we had to patch it. Or, oh yeah, we had to replace this door. It's instead like the willpower that this man had, the self-regulation that I didn't think he had, he was exercising way more than I was in order to not. If I was pissed and I need to leave and he was blocking the door, I would have done everything that I could. He's twice my size and like, you know, a whole foot taller than me almost. So like, I would have tried very hard and failed. He could have and succeeded very quickly. But there was so much of that that I didn't even take into account. I couldn't see it. And I often use this phrasing, I don't even know where I got it from, that we can't read the label from inside the jar. And it was so clear to me. And now, of course, I'm just like, all right, you need to leave. Just share with me that you need to leave. Right? Like, just don't hang up. If you get overwhelmed, say like, hey, I need to hang up the phone, and I will honor that. And please don't just like storm out. Don't just hang up. Don't just leave. That's, you know, and here's announce, where we can be. That like interdependence.
Or describe like, is really a better way. So the way that I talk about a lot of the stuff that you just said is I realized I'm the problem, but I mean that in an empowering way, Davina, not a self-deprecating way. Because if I'm the problem, then I get to be the solution. If everybody else is the problem, I'm screwed. Right? And if you're seeing the same kind of dynamics in multiple areas of your life, I've got news for you. You are the common denominator. And this is info, not ammo. This is information for you to learn, integrate, and grow from. It is not ammunition to beat yourself up. So when I learned that phrase, info, not ammo, it was like, oh my God, this is a godsend for me, because I thought I was like Miss High Self-Esteem and I liked myself, and I got in recovery and I realized, oh my God, I'm literally like scanning the horizon for reasons to beat myself up all the time. So info, not ammo is a way to go from self-judgment to self-compassion, because when we're looking at stuff as information rather than ammunition, we're being curious. And I love curiosity because it's neutral. So curiosity is that bridge that gets you from self-judgment to self-compassion. So when you're like, oh my God, I'm the problem, this is info, not ammo. So you get to say, okay, what could I be doing differently? What is the need I'm trying to meet in this surreptitious, perhaps super dysfunctional way? And how could I do it directly? Instead of trying to go around the bend, go right through it and say, this doesn't work for me, or whatever the situation is. So that idea that I'm the problem, it actually gives you a lot more control. It shows you you have way more control over your life than you think you do. And I think that's one of the very surprising things that happens for my clients, is they're like, I literally spent all my energy trying to control other people and zero trying to control me. And when I flip that around, I had so much more impact on my life. Because when you're trying to focus on people, places, and things and controlling them, that's an outward, the energy is going outward. So that's a drain. Well, the fact that it's going outward towards things you cannot control, it's an endless drain. So if you're drained of energy, it might be because you have no boundaries. But when you start putting the energy into yourself, into things you can control, you're so much more energized, not just because the drains have ended, but because you're putting your effort and your energy into actually doing things about which you have agency, you know, and you're making conscious choices about how to live. I mean, that's to me what having healthy boundaries is about, is I call it living on purpose. Some people call it like being proactive about your life, like being intentional about your life. Like, this is how I want to live, and I'm going to live that way. And I'm going to set boundaries to uphold those standards I have for my life.
Yeah. You know, I want to make a little bit of a pivot, because what you just reminded me of is parenting. And when I was doing this work, we were already parents, right? And again, we rewrote the narrative of our marriage, of our parenting, of all of these types of things. And I didn't have, my therapist might argue against this, but I didn't have like super high trauma growing up, right? My parents separated when I was 5. They still maintained a good relationship. My eldest brother battled addiction from the time I was about 12 or so, and then it just got worse and worse. And there were these types of things where I had a very loving home. I needed for nothing. I needed for nothing physical. I needed emotional safety. I needed to have people be curious about how I was feeling and coach me through what to feel. Not even what to feel. Coach me through how to understand what it is that I'm feeling, label it, and move through it. Mm-hmm. So now with parenting, I feel so much dissonance between how I was raised and then the resentment and really the envy that I have that my kids are being raised in a different way when it comes to the emotional availability. Mm-hmm. And also this recognition that their childhood is so short, but the first 15 years determine the next 50. So mm-hmm. I don't get to tailor them to how I want them to behave in the world. I have to tailor them and coach and mentor them into a way to take that into the world so that they can protect themselves and also not be the wound mm-hmm. for others, like the cause of mm-hmm. other wounding. And that's something that I think is so incredibly challenging. And when we're talking about like control what you can, a lot of people say like control your kids, like get mm-hmm. your kids under control. And in reality, when we're talking about the difference between boundary and control, right? I share with my kids, like I don't tell them you're not allowed to hit me. They're going to hit, they're going to be overwhelmed, they're big emotions and little bodies, right? What I tend to tell them is that I do not stay near people who hurt me. So I am going to be moving over here. And if you follow, I will be moving out over there and I will put a door between us, right? And I'm really doing my best, my God, Barb, my best to model that in a way that they don't adopt this language that says you're not allowed to hit me. If you don't hit me, then I will be fine. And of course, outside of like abusive shit later on, that's not what we're talking about here. There's that mm-hmm. part that I'm really working on being so selective in my wording so they don't think like, oh, all I do is have to tell them not to be this way. And that right. is. And so with parenting, those boundaries are really challenging. So I'm wondering, what advice do you have for people who are either newer or experienced in their parenting like journey? I don't like that word. Experience. And fight this part of what the difference is between boundary and control.
Yeah. So I want to start by saying I am not a parent.
Okay.
Second, I want to say what you said, that, you know, your trauma wasn't off the charts. What you described is emotional abandonment, which is the vast majority of people in the ACA program is that's the trauma. It's traumatizing. It's little t or relational trauma. And that is the stuff that like seeps into the cracks and crevices of our lives, our bones, our cells, our DNA, and that sort of thing. But I think having some kind of support is absolutely paramount. So you went through some kind of a training program. I'm in 12-step recovery. I think one of the most painful things for my fellows in recovery is for those who are parents, especially if their kids are already grown, and how remorseful they are about all the things that they did. They were doing the best they could, and they know that, but they had no idea. They were trying to be better than their parents, and they probably were. But when they see like all the things that happened to them and all the stories from other people, they're like, oh my God, like I screwed up my kid. So they have like the resentment against the parents, and then the resentment and perhaps self-hatred against themselves. And this is one reason why the 12-step program is so fantastic, because it's a stepwise program and you do things eventually, like let go of resentments and make amends to people, including yourself. So I think having some kind of support somewhere, I'm a big fan of group stuff. I was in therapy for literally 37 years, not continuously, before recovery, and it didn't do shit for me. You know, like my therapists were like mediocre at best. They were mostly sounding boards. My last therapist when I got in recovery was a trauma therapist, but I didn't know it until after I was in ACA and identified all this stuff. And she was definitely better than my other therapist, but not, she didn't say you're codependent, you're intergenerational family dysfunction, you have trauma, you're a compulsive overeater, you lie all the time, you know, you have victim mentality, like none. Literally all the things that I learned in recovery, none of it came out in my 37 years of therapy, 70 gazillion self-help books, research, seminars, workshops, workbooks, spiritual, blah, 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 all that stuff. So for me, the 12 steps are where it's at. I know there are plenty of talented professionals out there, but there are also some pretty shitty ones. But in a group setting, especially something like 12-step recovery, where there are always people at different places on the different levels of experience, you get to get experience from people who've actually gone through the transformation that you've gone through. You get to help other people, even if you're brand new, by just sharing your story. So you start to develop these hopefully interdependent relationships with others. But I think, you know, it's absolutely about support. It sounds to me like you are really conscious, and not everybody is. Like you said, we rewrote the narrative of our marriage and our parenting. Like how many have you, I've never heard anybody say that before. That's amazing that you did that. And the fact that you're so mindful about the language that you use, like not everybody's capable of that. But I think like the way that I think about it, when I coach my clients, I have them go through this exercise to name their top, to come up with a list of their top five values. And it's not just naming them. They talk about what does it mean to me and why is it important to me? And they use them as guideposts for when and where to set boundaries. And what this is about is bringing them into integrity with themselves. So they start making decisions and setting boundaries in alignment with what they know to be important to them. Well, for parents, I would say pick a handful of values. These are the values we are going to hammer home with our kids, and we're kind of going to let other things go by the wayside. Not all the time, but like these are the five things that we really want our children to grow into adulthood having as core values in their lives. And then stick with those, because you can't do everything and you can't be everything and you can't be everywhere. So I would say, you know, that would be my second point, is like pick values that, you know, ideally you and your co-parent would agree on. You know, that would be ideal. And also be really clear to your kids, like this is a value of this family, like maybe even have them hanging on the wall. And it doesn't mean other values are not important, they're just not the most important in this family. And you may have different values when you grow up and create your own family.
I mean, I love that advice, and I do think that it's it was definitely really challenging for us to do this work. And we were, by that point, thankfully, finally on the same page, right? Like 9 years into our relationship, 5 years into our marriage, maybe four. I don't know. I can't do math that quickly right now. We were so far along, and thankfully, we were aligned. We wanted to, we were parallel, right? We both were ready for this. And it's because we kind of set up these parameters within ourselves, where he was able to set some boundaries around like what it is that he needed. I shared with him that I will raise my children with an alcoholic. No problem. Happily, that's what I want. I won't show them an active alcoholic though. So like, if that's not a route that you're going to go toward recovery, then I will not keep them from you. I will protect them from your wounding that is manifesting through this shit, right? And we so often aren't aligned And that's why a lot of my clients for anger management, and now I'm pivoting more so into the parenting to kind of go over these types of things that he and I did and you know, just coach people through this experience. And it's that if I'm not aligned, if my husband I think he's more of the exception than the rule, unfortunately. Well, fortunately for us, unfortunately for, you know, a different version of me in a different dimension. There's that part that had he not, so many things would look so differently. And it's so hard to kind of like, quote unquote, undo what the other parent does in their household when they have our kids half of that time.
Absolutely.
Right. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right that getting both people on the same page can be difficult because of the blame game, because of the victim mentality. Like, we want them to be at fault. So even, I've heard it said that it only takes one person to change the nature of a relationship. The problem with us is that we always think it's the other person, but it's you.
100%.
Right. Yeah. So you get to change and you get to move in the direction that you want to live your life. And if your partner doesn't want to go along, then you have to decide, is this going to work for me or is this not going to work for me? So I think focus on yourself first. And then clean up your side of the street. That's an expression we use all the time in recovery. Like, clean up your side of the street. And when your side of the street is clean, then you say to your co-parent, I've done these things. This is the direction I want to head in. Do you want to come with me? Mm-hmm. And let them decide if they want to and then how they're going to go about doing it. And then hold them accountable.
Yeah. And that's where I think it's hard because if this hadn't come to me when I was ready for it and my husband was pushing, and if he was doing it in a way that like didn't align with how I needed to hear it because he needed to word it perfectly, I would have resisted purely because it wasn't my idea, right? And there's like a lot of that ego death that we had to do. There's just that shit that I think it is, of course, about the way that we present things and being mindful of those types of things. And some of us are just going to be so resistant no matter how cute you package it.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm curious though, how do you operate? Are you within a group coaching? Is it one-to-one? Is it self-led? How can people work with you?
No, so I do a 12-week one-on-one coaching program. I do groups from time to time. I don't have one that I'm offering right now.
Okay.
But my 12-week private coaching program is my flagship. I do have a couple of other smaller packages, one of which people can upgrade into the 12-week boundaries coaching program. But I also offer a free boundary building starter kit. If people go to boundariesstarterkit.com, it's free. It's a multimedia kit, and it's for people who say yes when they really want to say no, who want like tips and scripts for what to say. It's got like my most important type of boundaries. I call them boundaries of self-containment. There's a whole module on that. So there's like, it's very robust.
I love that. I will be downloading that because I want to see that too. Yeah, for sure. And where do you prefer that people find you if they want to learn more or if they want to work with you directly?
Yeah. So my favorite place on social media hangout is on Instagram. I'm at Higher Power Coaching, and you can just message me there. And I would love it if they would listen to my podcast, which is called Fragmented to Whole: Life Lessons from 12-Step Recovery. So you can either go to fragmentedtowhole.com, or since you're already listening on a podcast app, hop on over to it on your favorite podcast app. I've got 312 episodes and 40 something of which are about boundaries. And actually, in the starter kit, there's a playlist of just the episodes about boundaries. And every time I add another episode about boundaries, it just automatically gets uploaded to the playlist.
Amazing. Okay, perfect. And I'll link all of that here in the show notes too.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much for joining me,
Barb. Thank you. It was so great to meet you. Yeah, I love this conversation. Thank you so much.